Well, reflecting on what I thought it might be interesting to share this evening, what I'd like to start with is setting side by side two different sort of concepts or ways of thinking about the Dharma and what it means to seek and attain freedom in this tradition. The Buddha, when he began to teach, and throughout his 45-year teaching career, the metaphor that he most frequently used was one of being on the path, okay, of setting forth, going forth on a spiritual journey. And so his teachings on attaining ultimate freedom, he called the Eightfold Path, in that they were practices that one does on a continuous basis toward this increasing sense of freedom, of letting go, of finding oneself living the blameless life, one that does not contribute to your own suffering, anyone else's, and in fact eases suffering, okay, leads to the cessation of suffering. And that, of course, is literally what he did. When he began his own spiritual quest, he walked out on his family. You know, his wife and son and his harem and his, you know, his parents, everybody. He just took a powder and went off into the boonies for 6 years and lived the life of an ascetic and a wanderer and a spiritual seeker. When he attained enlightenment and decided that he wanted to share with others the means by which he did this, okay, the first people with whom he spoke and the first people he taught were people like himself who had gone forth. It was a time in India when there was enough surplus wealth in society that people who wanted to learn spiritual teachings would support those who were offering them. And so, as his group of followers grew in size, there was adequate support for what it was they wanted, you know, what they were about doing. Essentially, the Buddha and his followers were homeless panhandlers. You know? And their robes were made out of cast-off, worn-out fabrics of one kind or another, and they'd sew them together into robes. And they dyed them down on the riverbanks using whatever clays were there. And that tended to be what you see, these sort of rust-colored and part yellow, saffron color robes. And that's where that tradition comes from. And then, as his followings got, you know, more voluminous, and as more and more people came to him, eventually they were kind of like a sort of a flock of friendly locusts, you know. they'd come through town, but there were a whole lot of them, and it was getting harder and harder for local communities to, you know, help them establish their practice. And so eventually there would be some wealthy benefactors that would set aside lands where they could come and hang out for extended periods of time, especially during the rains retreat, during the, you know, the rainy season. And so we had these kind of semi-established monasteries or big, like, you know, church camps, you know, big extensive campsites that were developed. But it was still made up of monastics who had gone forth, who had left the what is called the life of the householder, and who had become wandering ascetics, and then eventually found refuge in the Buddhist Sangha. So in the teachings of the Buddha, in the Pali Canon and in the early commentaries, there's a kind of a significant distinction made in that the Buddha's advice was basically to do as he did, was to go forth into the homeless life and do these practices, you know, do meditation practice, study the Dharma, hang out with other people who are doing the same thing. And then eventually the combination of these experiences can have a transformative experience, or effect on one's life and one's consciousness. As these gatherings of monastics grew in size and number, inevitably when people were trying to live together in community, they'd get jammed up, there'd be stuff happen. And so whenever that would occur, what they would do would be to come to the Buddha, and they'd say, okay, well, such and such a dispute happened over such and such a subject. How should we deal with it? How should we apply your teachings to deal with it? And he would listen to the case, and then he would make a ruling, basically. And then they started compiling all those decisions that he made into something called the Vinaya. And it was a code of conduct for people in monastic sanghas, okay? Sort of rules to live by. About 225 for male monks and a good deal more for female monastics. The idea being that if you had this great, long, extensive list of rules that governed every aspect of how you spent every day, and even the falling asleep part and the waking up part and all of that, the idea being that if you are constantly dwelling, you know, thinking about what those rules are, it essentially compels mindfulness. You know, you don't have the option of living an unmindful life. That this is the way that you are going to do it. And it's what is called the Theravada Buddhism, the way of the Arhat, the person who has devoted his or her life to seeking ultimate freedom. And not surprisingly, it came to be the view of the monastics that the only means by which one could attain full enlightenment was through the way of the Arhat. That one had to become a monastic in order to achieve that attainment. And so this question arose because the Buddha was a little cagier about it. He didn't make such an unequivocal ruling. This question arose as to whether or not you had to be a monastic, one gone forth into the homeless life in order to achieve ultimate freedom, or whether in fact that was also a possibility for householders. Not surprisingly, the monastics for the most part took the former view. The Buddha was more equivocal. He basically said, wearing the robes and living by the rules and doing the chants is not going to lead to liberation. That's form, right? And you can train monkeys to do a lot of that stuff, right? In terms of ways to behave and whatnot. And he said that achieving ultimate freedom is not simply a matter of doing those things, especially if you find yourself getting attached to those rites and rituals, you know, or attached to the rule book, and you decide that if I do these things, then I'm going to get there. He said what really matters is what's going on in the heart. You know, whether doing practice, meditation practice, whether studying sincerely these teachings that are there, whether doing your very best to live a blameless life in terms of your relationship with others and how you treat yourself, okay? That's what brings about the transformation in the heart-mind that can make liberation possible. And so not only did he point that out in several of his teachings, but there are also stories of him being with householders, oftentimes right toward the end of their lives, who had really been, you know, doing everything they could to lead the blameless life and doing those practices and whatnot, and who, especially nearing death, became fully enlightened, okay, without having become arhats. Okay. So it's a much more kind of subtle take on it, insofar as where the Buddha was coming from himself. But again, the dominant metaphor is one of going forth, being on the path, and then along the way you take refuge in the Buddha, you know, his being. Take refuge in your own Buddha nature, your own inherent wisdom and compassion. Okay. Take refuge in what you know to be true, as well as those teachings that you have discovered, that you've come across, that resonate with you, and that have the effect of transforming one's consciousness, making freedom possible. Being with others in a way that has integrity, that allows you to be the best that you are. And, you know, and like I think I've said in here before a couple of times, you know, near the end of my mother-in-law's life, I was asking her if she had any advice she would like to impart. And by this time, dementia was a pretty significant feature of her consciousness. And so I never knew, none of us ever knew, you know, when we asked her a question, what we were going to get in response, or whether we were going to get a response from the day or from 1938 or, you know, wherever the mind happened to be hanging out at that point in time. But when I asked her that question, do you have any advice? You know, it was right around, I think it was the day after the memorial service for her husband, actually, a memorial meeting for worship at her Quaker retirement home in Pennsylvania. So I asked her that question, and then there's a little pause, and then she looked straight at me, almost as if she was looking through me. She said, yes, it's really important to be with others in a way that brings out the best in them. So they feel better about themselves for having been around you. Straight up Dharma, you know? It's like, yes, thank you. Okay. I didn't know my mother-in-law was a bodhisattva until then. So, being with, you know, whether you're in a monastic sangha or not, being with others in a way that helps bring out the best in them. Okay. That's an awful lot of what taking refuge in the sangha is all about. So, another set of metaphors that occurs frequently, however, is the one of being at home, right? Especially in the teachings of the Buddha, in the Brahmaviharas, you know, having the mind come to rest, having the mind come to inhabit compassion, to be compassion, to be selfless joy, to be generosity, to be open-heartedness, so that when your mind is those things, okay, then in the deepest sense, you are at home. There is a really interesting metaphor that's discussed in a commentary, an ancient commentary on the Buddha's teachings called the Visuddhimagga, Path of Purification. It was a compendium of the experiences of some monastics living in Sri Lanka that were put down in writing by a scholar named Buddhaghosa about 1,000 years after the Buddha died, about 500-600 Common Era. And I had always thought that this practice was something that the British sailors invented, but it turns out they were doing it in sailing the Indian Ocean, you know, 580. And that is this navigational device that they use. You know, it's really kind of nasty weather in the Indian Ocean, and especially if they're off a ways, you know, out into the ocean, they would they get blown off course, and especially if it was cloudy, or, you know, they didn't have much idea of where they were. So what they did was they take on board on their ships a couple of cages of crows. Crows are land birds. Crows hate the water. They never voluntarily go near the water. You know, they don't eat anything from water. They don't like to be around it. They can't swim. It's just a real bummer. And so they would take these crows out on their ships. Okay. And if they got lost, they're out there, had no idea where they were. They actually did have a little roost up there on the masts for the crows to hang out. And somebody's job was to take care of the crows. And so what they would do is that they would climb up the mast and they would release one of these crows. Okay. And they knew the crow hated being on the ship and would really like to find land wherever they could. So what they would then do is to watch the crow fly around in the sky, because the crow was up there trying to see if he could see any land. And then if he couldn't find any land, then he'd come back down to the ship again and take him downstairs. But they would do this whenever they were lost to see if the crow was going to be able to find land for them. And so once they got, you know, in some proximity to land, whether they knew it or not, because the crow could fly so much higher than they could, okay, the crow could see the land, smell the land. And so if at some point they release one of these crows, and instead of just flying around, the crow takes off in a straight line somewhere, then they knew on the ship that the crow had found land. Okay. And so they would follow the course of the crow. And some, you know, some birds kind of swoop around and go hither and yon and whatnot. Crows don't. They fly directly in one, you know, wherever they're going, they fly straight there. My old East Texas relatives used to talk about, well, you know, it's 20 miles by road, but 15 miles as a crow flies. You know, that's what that means. They fly a very straight path wherever they're going. So what they said in the Visuddhimagga, what it means to be on the spiritual path, it's like the crow. It's, you're flying around there looking for what seems to be the appropriate path, what seems to be the appropriate mode of teaching, okay? And then once you discover a realm of teaching or a practice tradition or whatever that resonates with you, you go, aha, it feels like you're being reminded of something you already knew, okay? What they say in the Visuddhimagga is it's very much like the crow. When you set out on the path, you're flying home. You're going to the place where you belong. Okay? And that you know where that place is just as instinctively as the crow knows where the land is. My family and I had the good fortune to live for 6 months in New Zealand. And it was, I'm doing a Fulbright at the University of Auckland. And out on the west coast of the North Island, just a few miles over the Waitakere Range from Auckland, is Mirawai Beach. Mirawai Beach is the home to a colony of birds called the Australasian Gannet. And the gannet is a bird that looks, it's kind of like a big seagull, only much more streamlined. And it has a beak that looks like a spearhead, you know, long, sharp beak. And the way the Australasian gannet makes its living is that they fly out over the water looking for fish near the surface of the water. And then when they see one, they go into a vertical dive, like a javelin, right straight down into the water, and they've been observed going down as deep as 30 feet into the ocean to nail the fish, spear the fish that they want, bring it back up and either eat it or take it back to the nest if they're feeding young. And they live on a cliff overlooking the Tasman Sea, cliffs, you know, they're about 300-400 feet vertical cliffs. You know, most little birdies, when they learn to fly, they hop from branch to branch and twig to twig, you know, and flap their wings a little bit and gradually get the hang of it. The way the parents of the Australasian Gannet parents teach their kids to fly is every day as they're getting closer to being able to fly, they walk them over to the edge of the cliff. And then the parent dives off the cliff straight down and then spreads its wings, flips up into the air. The average westerly wind coming over the Tasman Sea is 35 to 50 miles an hour as it tears over these cliffs, right? And so eventually that little bird has got to leap off the cliff, or it's never going to learn to feed itself, and then spread its wings just like it saw its parent do. And when it does that, at that point in time, you know, about 500,000 years of evolution all comes together. And the little bird either learns to fly or it gets flipped back against the cliff and gets recycled. And there's actually a kind of a steep mortality rate among Australian gannets because not all those little birds get the hang of it. But the ones that do, they go out and they go fishing with their folks, and then a few months, you know, short of their first birthday, what happens is the gannets all migrate 1,500 miles across the Tasman Sea to Australia. And so they go to their other feeding grounds there, and they hang out in Australia for a few months, and then it's time to go back to the nest site. And when they go back to the nest site, they do it in waves. First go the adult males, and they go back there to the colony, and they squabble about real estate, you know, who's going to get what nests, you know, and so they carve out their territory. Next wave is the adult females. And so then they all show up and then, you know, start home life. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, after all the adults have left, really study this one carefully, it's just the teenagers hanging out, you know, spring break down there in southeastern Australia, you know, party hardy, gorging themselves, having a great time. And then on some given day, they all form up and all the yearlings fly 1,500 miles back across the Tasman Sea on a course they've never flown before and land in the nest where they were born. So, just like with the crow, something is going on that makes that a possibility. And it's the same metaphor, it has the same validity insofar as what we're doing. What we're doing in some really important way is going home. We're doing this practice. You know, we're on that. We're on that, you know, flying by wire, you know. And there's something happening with regard to what I call our own spiritual intuition that helps us stay on that course until we get there. Okay. And at the same time, you've heard it said, perhaps in this tradition, that the journey is the destination. You know, that it's the actual practice. You know, that when the Buddha was talking, teaching the Brahmaviharas to the scholar Subha, you know, he said, this is not a journey to somewhere up in heaven. It's a journey inside. It's a journey to your innermost self. You know, that's where the Brahmaviharas are. That's where your spiritual intuition lies. That's where your capacity for compassion and selfless joy and equanimity and open-heartedness lies. Okay. When you're going home, when you're flying home, you're going to that inner place. Okay. It has different names in different traditions. In Spanish culture, it's called the Cadencia. This is a book by Rachel Ruman, a physician who, like other physicians who themselves experienced very serious life-threatening illness, learned what the shortcomings of Western medicine were, and began to really investigate how to not just cure but heal, you know, with people that she was working with, you know, how important spiritual healing was as an element of becoming well again, if that's what the body's meant to do. She worked with a lot of people, however, who were also terminally ill and who eventually succumbed to one disease or another. She writes this. In a book about Spain, I remember reading an interesting thing about bullfighting. There is a place in the bull ring where the bull feels safe. If he can reach this place, he stops running and can gather his full strength. He is no longer afraid. From the point of view of his opponent, he becomes dangerous. This place in the ring is different for every bull. It's the job of the matador to be aware of this, to know where the sanctuary lies for each and every bull, to be sure the bull does not occupy this place of wholeness. In bullfighting, the safe place is called the cadencia. For humans, the cadencia is a place in our inner world. Often it is a familiar place that has not been noticed until a time of crisis. Sometimes it is a viewpoint, a position from which to conduct a life. It's different for each person. Often it is simply a place of deep inner silence. In working with people with cancer, I have seen the change which happens when a person finds their cadencia. In full view of the matador, they are calm and peaceful and wise. They have gathered their strength around them. The inner silence is more secure than any hiding place. So, how to find our cadencia? Where does it lie? We know it's in there somewhere. We know the things that make it possible to find it, to be in it, to live it, are available to us through these practices we do, through our own self-respect, positive regard, and desire to live with integrity. Okay. A desire to be genuinely kind to ourselves. Somebody once asked me, you know, what's this practice about? One of the answers I sometimes give is learning to be a better friend to yourself. You know? A friend in the spiritual sense. Finding that place of safety. And that's not one, you know, as she points out, it's not running away and hiding. Okay, it's being in that place that allows you to be with all things. Whatever it is that happens to be going on. A few weeks ago, I decided I beat a hasty retreat from Denver winters, and I went down to spend a couple of weeks in Tucson, which is my hometown. It's where I grew up. I'm a native of the Southwest. When I was a kid growing up, especially from about age 10 until high school and went into the service. We lived in a house that my parents had built in the Tucson Mountains, west of the city. And the San Pedro Valley, where Tucson is ringed by mountains. So there's the Tucson Mountains on the west, and the Catalina Mountains on the north, and the Rincons on the east, and the Santa Rita's on the south, and they're all very distinct in their profile. So whenever I get to Tucson, just being there feels like home. You know, it's like I know where I am. And so we lived a fairly isolated life up in the desert mountains before there was much real estate development going on. And it was a nice home on 5 acres or so of land. Unfortunately, at home at the time, there was a Cold War that had commenced between my parents that lasted for the better part of a decade. I went away into the service. My parents finally divorced, sold the house. By the time I came out of recruit training in the military, everything was gone. My family had and sort of dissipated. And the place where I'd grown up wasn't there. You know, it was there, but it wasn't ours anymore. And I realized that during all that time that things were getting worse and worse at home, it just felt uncomfortable to be there, mostly just because of the silence and the tense undercurrent. My younger brother and sister, and we all knew that things were not well, and so we all spent as much time as we could elsewhere. For me, I'd go off for long, long walks in the desert mountains, you know, and right around where we were, there were a lot of the saguaro cactus, for instance. And for me, being in the saguaro forest is a lot like being in the redwoods. It's like, it feels like the area is inhabited by some kind of collective consciousness, you know, they're part of that, you know, those giant plants, you know. And it's like when I would go walking in the desert in the evenings, in the late afternoon, evening, dusk, you know, that's where I felt at home. You know, that's where I felt the things that we associate with being at home. Comfortable, secure, at ease. You know, this sense of belonging. Yes, this is my place. You know, this is, I'm here. I'm just, and yet just this sense of connection with everything that is. Right? For various of us, it's different places that we may have hung out or may have been. But ultimately, in Buddha Dharma, home is a state of mind. It's a state of the heart mind. Okay? And whether it's like the crows, the Australasian gannets, you know, we know when we're at home, and we know what coming home feels like. And we also know when we're not, you know, when we're off center or something, you know, in all of the martial arts, there's a lot of, in the Chinese martial arts called the Tantian, the center of gravity. Okay. And in the teaching of all the Asian martial arts, everything emanates from that place. So all your motions, your balance, everything that you do by way of defending yourself, you know, whatnot, emanates from this place of balance, this place of poise. Okay. And so in spiritual life, it's very much the same thing. You know, this center of gravity, this, and it's basically el ojo del barrasco, in 1900, there was a monstrous hurricane that ripped through the Gulf of Mexico and destroyed the coastal town of Galveston, Texas. And the priests who were throughout the Caribbean islands, the Jesuits, you know, the scientists, they had these little outposts that were sort of outstations of the Vatican Observatory. So what they would do is they were keeping very careful records of wind direction, wind speed, when it changed, what was going on, and then they would telegraph from all these different little missions throughout the Caribbean. They would telegraph their data to Havana, and the people there at the observatory there would look at all these data. And what they began to see was an anti-cyclonic movement. They're the ones who discovered it. And they saw this 400-mile-wide anti-cyclonic storm moving, you know, toward the Gulf Coast. And they contacted the American Weather Service, and they said, "We think there is a monster storm that's going to hit the Texas coast, you know, within, you know, a day or so, and you should probably start taking precautions." The American, and they said, what it looks like to us is this giant counterclockwise mass that when it becomes strong enough, it creates a spot in the middle that they call El Ojo del Barrasco, the eye of the storm, that when the storm becomes powerful enough, this still place in the middle opens up. And the Americans just blew them off. They said, "What are those guys been smoking?" You know, it's like, you know, where did they get that one from? You know, with something that's going to eye open in the storm. That's ridiculous. Well, of course, about a day and a half later, this, the town of Galveston was hit by the biggest storm in the history of the Gulf Coast, and it immediately washed about 8,000 people out to sea. Completely level the city, which is built 8 feet above sea level. That kind of got the point across. Then all of a sudden, all the weather maps started, yeah, sure enough, they were right, that's how it works. And I think that's how it works for us too. You know, sometimes when it feels, emotions get powerful and you're really trying to find that place, all of a sudden you can feel it open up, you know, whatever else is going on around, whatever energies are swirling around us, something is opened up in the middle where it's quiet and still, and it becomes possible to know all things. So whether it's the eye of the hurricane to the cadencia, the Brahma Viharas, and the heart, that's home. So, any questions? Share your thoughts. What's your experience of this?
So, I'm curious about if there is a time when sort of the society has a consciousness where they reach that place, that calm place. I'm kind of wishing for that right now.
Are not we all? I think that happens when enough people really, really want it to happen. You know, when we have belabored ourselves to the point where it's become apparent that the way we're doing things is not satisfactory, it's not going to work. It seems to have mostly in our own history been only at times of crisis, genuine crisis. When that's occurred, you know, wars not of our own making, that where we were fighting for our lives, literally, you know, have been one of those times. And I would like to think that if we ever get to the point where enough of us see the need for that to occur, it can. You know, it's one of the reasons that I think it'd be great if our Sangha not only could, you know, be better linked with other sanghas, but also with other communities of faith. You know, there is a lot of work to be done out there, and finding other like-minded people who are doing it from a spirit of beneficial intention rather than a more kind of adversarial making the other the enemy, I think is desperately needed now. You know, whether it's with regard to weapons control or domestic violence or the violence that's being wrought on our environment now, you know, is remarkable. You know, it's remarkable in my lifetime. I've been teaching environmental law for 30 years. I've never seen anything like this. So it would be good to think that that could be the case. Yeah, thank you.
I like the analogy of the crow. I think of myself more like a chickadee.
Say more what you mean. Flitting about, you mean?
If you watch a chickadee, it sort of flits about from branch to branch. I think it's happy. Does a lot of chirping. I think having benefit of looking back on my many decades, I reflect on the fact that I've had many opportunities to iterate, to move to another branch.
Yeah.
And perhaps, hopefully, take a little wisdom as at each juncture. But I've never had that experience of being with a crow.
Yeah. I have a home bird feeder, and I had a couple of them, and I really enjoy, you know, feeding the birds and watching them come. So I've gotten slightly more elaborate ones over the time. This one has a couple of hane things, and it's got a main place to put seed, and then it's got two little cages on either side for those little suet cakes and whatnot. So what happens is a very substantial variety of birds show up, you know, different sizes and different behaviors. They like to eat different stuff around there. And I've really been interested in noticing these subtle differences in their behavior. You know, they all have somewhat different ways to make a living, you know, as far as how they do things, their style and whatnot. And each style, in terms of including what they eat and how they behave, and this, each style is the natural path for that species. And I think that the same may well be true for us. You know, that we have different styles. We go about this differently. We don't all, we're not all single-mindedly dedicated to a particular path, you know. What we're seeking to do is to inquire into what our own nature is and honor that, I think. So I wouldn't feel bad about being a chicken. It may well still be getting you where you want to go. Just look out for the hawks. Okay.
Is there anything else you could say about being at home or going toward, like, being on the spiritual path, but being in the world taking skillful action? Because I find my boyfriend works with immigrants groups, and a lot of times he's sharing with me, and I feel this, like, almost like aversion to, like, they're fighting and they're, like, making all these people wrong, and they're, like, to me, I'm like trying to find the balance of how to be in the world taking action while coming from a place of genuine, like, skillfulness. And if I have found it somewhat difficult for myself.
Yes, of course. Of course, me too. All the environmental justice work I do, you know, we're dealing with this case up in Greeley right now where there is an oil company that wanted to put in a really, really big complex of well pads and do slant drilling in about 24 different directions and whatnot. Huge thing about the size of the Cherry Creek Mall. That was going to be within 1,000 feet of some school buildings. And it was a nice part of town, about 80% white, and the citizens got all up about it, and they organized and they pressured the county commissioners to waive the, you know, to not grant permission and whatnot. So the company could see the political opposition that was coming, so it found another site where it could get to most of the same deposits by another elementary, by another junior high school. Okay, that was 80% Latino. And city, county didn't have any problem with that. And neither did the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission. Okay. And they said, hey, we're 1,000 feet from the school buildings. But the way the law reads, it's 1,000 feet from the school buildings, not the school yards. Kids are gonna be playing in the playground, running around, breathing lungfuls of air about 400 or 500 feet from places exuding carcinogenic chemicals, like benzene, okay? Microparticulate diesel exhaust. City didn't have a problem, county didn't have a problem, Colorado Oil and Gas Commission doesn't have a problem, they do now, we're suing them. You know, this is one of the most blatant cases of environmental racism that any of us have ever come across. It's just astounding what the city of Greeley and the county, Weld County, which makes a lot of money on oil and gas, is willing to do to people who don't have the power to protect themselves. It's outrageous. You know, we're going to sue them very much for a long time and do everything possible to point out what, in our view, is the moral culpability in their decision making, public shaming, right? And it is so easy for me to get up about that. You know, the last two executive directors in the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission, the day after they quit, they went to work for the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm.
Right after they had gotten through making a whole lot of decisions in the industry's favor at the expense of the public health. You know, the system's rotten. You know, it's really, you know, it's like the government feels like a wholly owned subsidiary of the oil and gas, you know, industry sometimes, in my humble opinion. And as you can hear, you know, I get on a roll, it's, you know, the poly term is papancha, you know, make this great dramatic, you know, technicolor cinemascope movie about the whole thing. What keeps me from going completely over the edge is saying, you know, rather than just, you know, thinking of these people as being pure evil, is it's all about greed. It's all about attachment to wealth and power, you know. If we are really being honest with ourselves, we know what that feels like. We know what it feels like to be saturated with desire, you know. We know what it means to be saturated by aversion, you know, because that's going on too, you know. What I see is an industry so, in some ways, so desperate to maintain its power that it is willing to impose just about any costs on anyone that they have the power to impose that on for the sake of maintaining their own control. Because the fossil fuel industry is right now in a fight to the death, and they know it. And so, you know, they're getting ready to, the presidential administration has disauthorized oil and gas drilling just outside of Great Sand Dunes National Park, down the San Luis Valley, where I spent part of my summers. We're gonna go after them down there too, you know? But that's what's happening. They know they only have a finite number of years to get that stuff out of the ground and sell it and make money off of it before the climate change becomes so severe and so drastic that we'll have to switch over to renewables on kind of an emergency basis. So that's what's going on, okay. But what keeps me from demonizing the other side is to do what I can to be in touch with my own attachments and my own tendencies toward greed and grasping, and be in touch with my own aversive views, you know, that what I'm doing is making them wrong, rather than understanding that to some degree it's an entire industry that's inhabiting a hell realm. You know, they are at some level they know what they're doing, but basically they just want to try to get what they can out of the deal before it all collapses. Most of the people who are the ultimate senior control of the petroleum industry in particular are quite old white men who are within a very few years of death, and their industry is too, but they're not going to admit it, you know, and they'll be long gone before the ultimate consequences are visited on the rest of us, or our children and our grandchildren and others. Okay. To do that work, I think, like I was saying, you know, not so long ago when we were here, it requires, it means the practice of the Brahma Viharas is no longer an option. it's an absolute requirement. It's not possible to do this work without doing whatever is possible to keep the mind in that place, because otherwise you just crisp yourself. It's a recipe for horribly painful burnout and withdrawal, contraction. We need all of us on deck, doing this stuff in a non-dual way, in a way that's understanding, that's compassionate. And that's also, I think, where our effectiveness lies, you know. I couldn't do this stuff if I were not able to hang out in my cadencia from time to time, you know. That's usually when I sit, it's usually in the morning, so I can start the day from that place, you know, feeling kind of grounded, like, okay, I can do this, you know. Like it says in the recollections, you know, my actions are my relations, my actions are my protection. You know, to do this stuff in a skillful way that where we can maintain our self-respect, a sense of integrity, and that we're doing what we consider to be the right thing and with regard to the alleviation of suffering without either psychologically or otherwise harming another in the process. Thank you. Appreciate that. Anything else? Okay, let's return to sitting posture just a minute, please. May we all live with ease and rest in ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be free from all physical suffering and mental affliction. May we acknowledge and accept any suffering we find in ourselves or others with courage and with caring and with kindness. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. Those who want to can meet